You're listening to the RBN Energy Blogcast. This is an audio version of RBN Energy's daily blog, the oil and gas industry's go-to source for insight. Every day, we cover commodity fundamentals, industry changes, and developing trends across energy markets. And now, we're making it easier than ever to enjoy our blogs. Whether it's on your drive into work, while you're at the office, or at home walking the dog, settle in, turn the volume up, and enjoy.
Sunday, August 1st, 2021. Matter of Trust. Assessing the Energy Industry's Carbon-Related Initiatives. Published by Housley Carr. In case you hadn't noticed, there's a big push by the government, industry, and the broader public to reduce greenhouse gas, or GHG, emissions and to offset those that do occur. Given its carbon-intensive nature, the oil and gas sector is at the heart of this activity, with almost daily announcements about carbon-neutral LNG shipments, carbon dioxide capture and sequestration projects, and other efforts. The problem is, it can be difficult sometimes to figure out what's real and what's not, that is, which efforts have an actual, measurable impact and which are sort of vague or fuzzy and need to be sussed out. Today, we discuss the latest round of announcements by producers, midstreamers, refiners, and others to green up their operations and products. Back in the mid-1970s, Hall of Fame catcher Yogi Berra was the manager of the New York Mets and America was in the midst of a streaking fad. Stay with us on this. Well, there was a rain delay during a Mets spring training game in Florida and, to help pass the time, two streakers climbed over the outfield fence and sprinted across the wet grass, ending their run with belly flops onto the tarp-covered infield. The crowd went wild. The streakers were peacefully arrested. During his nightly phone call with his wife Carmen, who was back at the Barris home in New Jersey, Yogi mentioned the incident, and she asked, were they male or female streakers? Yogi thought a moment and answered, I'm not sure. They had bags over their heads. Which brings us to the spate of announcements by energy companies over the past few months, many of which we've blogged about, on the steps they're taking to reduce or offset their GHG emissions and produce what's referred to as either carbon neutral or net zero hydrocarbons. No, really, there's a connection here. There have been plans put forward to electrify some upstream operations or to run compressors and equipment on wind or solar power, to reduce venting and flaring, to better detect and plug leaks in pipelines, to capture CO2 from plant operations and permanently store it deep underground, to use carbon offsets to counterbalance the GHG emissions they or their products generate, and there are certainly other efforts not enumerated here. The point is, if you focus only on the bags on the heads of these initiatives, they'd all look similarly green and well-intentioned. But with just a little more scrutiny, you can see real differences between them. As we've said before, we've received an unprecedented number of inquiries the past year or so from current and prospective clients about the ESG movement and efforts to reduce GHGs. This led us to seriously educate ourselves about these and related topics, and ultimately to expand our areas of hydrocarbon-related expertise and our coverage in blogs and reports to include, among other things, ESG, hydrogen, and carbon capture, use and sequestration, or CCUS, particularly as it applies to enhanced oil recovery, or EOR. Our expansion seems increasingly prescient because nowadays it seems that almost every player in the energy space is trying to figure out how to adapt operations and corporate strategies to rapidly evolving demands from investors, lenders, customers, and the general public, not to mention governments. We're the first to admit that we still have a lot to learn about the space, but we will continue to take an unbiased approach when assessing the various proposals. Among the fastest-growing trends in the new greener energy industry relates to producers and marketers offering carbon-neutral or net-zero hydrocarbons. There have been well-publicized shipments of carbon-neutral crude oil, condensate, petrochemicals, and, most common of all, LNG. For a few years now, natural gas has been touted by LNG players as the perfect transition fuel for a lower-carbon world, even for countries that don't have large gas reserves of their own. After all, they say, natural gas not only has a smaller carbon footprint than coal or refined products, such as fuel oil and diesel, but gas-fired power plants, with their ability to quickly ramp up and cut their output, are an ideal complement to intermittent renewable resources like wind and solar. Gas has already achieved significant market share growth for power generation in the U.S. as well as for bunker fuel in the shipping industry. In the long term, there's also the potential for natural gas to be blended with hydrogen, further reducing GHG emissions. More recently, a number of LNG players have been seeking to differentiate their LNG from that supplied by their competitors. How? Mostly by offering buyers the option of contracting for carbon-neutral or net-zero LNG, where the full lifecycle emissions of their product, that is, the CO2 and other GHGs emitted during everything from natural gas production and liquefaction to shipping and gas consumption, are entirely mitigated, typically through the use of independently verified, nature-based carbon offsets. More on these in a moment. The world's first two shipments of carbon-neutral LNG were made just 2 years ago this month, in July 2019, both by Shell, to buyers in Japan, or Tokyo Gas, and South Korea, or GS Energy. Our understanding is that, for each of these deals, Shell used what UK regulators have established as a sort of standard for the life cycle, or Scope 1, Scope 2, and Scope 3, GHG emissions from the 70,000 metric tons of LNG carried in an average cargo. Under that standard, the LNG's life cycle emissions would total about 240,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalent, or CO2e, and, with each carbon offset credit equaling 1 metric tons of CO2e, Shell needed to use 240,000 credits to offset each cargo. Where did the credits come from? In Shell's case, the company has assembled a global portfolio of projects that are designed to either avoid the generation of CO2 or remove CO2 from the atmosphere. These projects fall into a few major categories, including conservation, sustainable management of forests, afforestation, planting trees where they had never been, and reforestation, planting trees in areas that have been deforested. Shell's portfolio in conservation and related projects undertaken by others act as a sort of carbon offset bank or store that Shell and other companies seeking to mitigate the GHG impact of their LNG, or crude oil, etc., can turn to in order to secure needed offsets. Shell makes a good poster child for CO2 offset initiatives because of its high-profile efforts, its status as a global energy leader, and, oh yeah, a landmark mandate handed to Shell by the Netherlands in May requiring a 45% reduction in the company's GHG emissions by 2030. That certainly got the industry's attention. You might wonder, as we did, does this kind of arrangement make the LNG that Shell delivered to Tokyo Gas and GS Energy, and that those companies or their customers consumed, genuinely carbon neutral? In other words, can it be proven that the life cycle emissions associated with 70,000 metric tons of LNG and consumed within a few days or weeks of delivery to Japan or South Korea equal, on a CO2e basis, the CO2 removed from the atmosphere by, say, a peatland restoration project in Indonesia or a deforestation prevention program at the Cordillera Azul National Park in Peru, both of which were cited by Shell as sources of the carbon offsets for its Tokyo Gas and GS Energy deals? The answer, as we see it, is yes and no. Why do we hedge? Well, while it's possible to make a relatively accurate assessment of the CO2 and other GHGs emitted during the production, liquefaction, shipping, and consumption of a certain amount of natural gas, it would seem to be a lot more difficult to measure with anywhere near as much precision the CO2 that is, one, absorbed by trees and plants as a result of conservation efforts in part of a 4-million-acre park in Peru, or two, not released into the atmosphere by preventing deforestation in the park, again as a result of conservation efforts. In addition to uncertainty about the volume of CO2 actually offset, there are also valid questions about the duration and efficacy of such efforts. Further, what's to stop deforestation from just moving down the road from the protected site? Or a wildfire destroying a protected forest? Other questions surround the actual accounting for such offset credits. When are they generated? Can they be double counted? It's also true, however, that all of the carbon offsets used by Shell, and as far as we can tell, from other companies offering net-zero LNG, are associated with projects that meet the requirements of one or more widely accepted standards, such as the Verified Carbon Standard, the Gold Standard, and the American Carbon Registry. In our view, these independent third-party verification programs, many of which were founded or co-founded by leading environmental groups, take CO2 offsets beyond being simply a matter of trust. The best of them act as a sort of gatekeeper to ensure not only that conservation and other projects provide GHG benefits that are incremental or additional to the status quo, but also that the carbon offset credits the projects generate are commensurate with their GHG benefits. That is, that something approximating 1 metric tons of incremental / additional CO2 will actually be avoided or absorbed for each 1 metric ton credit issued. That's not to say there aren't concerns about the use of carbon offsets. Some critics argue that many verified projects overpromise and underdeliver on the CO2 front. Others say that while the projects may be helpful, companies that generate large volumes of GHGs should not view carbon offsets as a sort of get-out-of-jail-free card, that instead, they should focus primarily, exclusively, some say, on reducing their actual CO2 and other GHG emissions. Companies like Shell have said they agree and that they see carbon offsets as only a relatively small part of their broader climate change-related efforts, The pejorative term greenwashing gets bandied about by those who view industry efforts like this as just a publicity move meant to appease investors and placate environmental activists. While there is surely at least some of that, offset programs can be a worthwhile step on a path toward a more environmentally friendly energy industry, particularly if reporting standards and rigor continue to develop. In the next blog in this series, we'll discuss the handful of other carbon-neutral LNG, crude oil, condensate, and even ethylene cargoes that have been shipped to date, as well as the prospects for more shipments in the coming months. After that, we'll look at efforts by producers, midstreamers, refiners, and other energy industry players to offset their GHG emissions with carbon offsets. There's a lot to learn about the CO2 market. That's why we are holding our third virtual conference in our It's a Gas series on August 10, 2021, this one focused on CO2. Like our other recent conferences on propane and hydrogen, It's a Gas, CO2 will bridge the gap between fundamentals analysis and boots-on-the-ground market intelligence. We will bring together the views of senior executives involved in the CO2 transition along with RBN's latest analysis of CO2 production, infrastructure, pipelines, and projects. For details, visit the events tab on our website at rbnenergy.com. A Matter of Trust was written by Billy Joel and appears as the third song on side one of his 10th studio album, The Bridge. Released as the second single from the album in July 1986, A Matter of Trust went to number 10 on the Billboard Hot 100 Singles chart. Personnel on the record were Billy Joel on lead, backing vocals, guitar, acoustic piano, and synthesizer, David Brown and Russell Javers on guitar, Doug Stegmeier on bass, Liberty DeVito on drums, and Jeff Bova on synthesizer. The Bridge was recorded in 1985-86 at the Power Station, Chelsea Sound, and RCA Studios in New York City and Evergreen Studios in Burbank, California. Produced by Phil Ramone, the album was released in July 1986. It went to number 7 on the Billboard Top 200 Albums chart and has been certified 2x platinum by the Recording Industry Association of America. 4 singles were released from the LP. Billy Joel is an American singer, songwriter, and musician from New York who has sold over 150 million records worldwide. He started his career as a member of the Hassles, who made 2 albums for United Artists in 1967 and 1969. Joel then formed the keyboard and drum duo, Attila, who released 1 album for Epic in 1970. Stephen Thomas Earlywine of AllMusic wrote, "Attila undoubtedly is the worst album released in the history of rock and roll." Joel himself has called the album psychedelic BS. He started his solo career in 1971 with the release of his debut album, Cold Spring Harbor. Billy Joel has released 13 studio albums, 6 live albums, 16 compilation albums, and 61 singles. He has won 5 Grammy Awards, is a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and has been awarded a Gershwin Prize for Popular Song from the Library of Congress and a Kennedy Center Honor. He continues to write music and occasionally perform live.
This has been the RBN Energy Blogcast. Thanks for listening.